the lesson we're going to talk about tonight is the method to study the Bible, PQ4R. And Carolyn asked me what I was going to talk about, and I said, I'm going to talk about PQ4R. And she said, "Where do you get these off-the-wall subjects?" But I think you'll understand when we go through this, how it can help us get more out of the Bible study. That's what it's all about, is to increase our Bible studying efficiency. PQ4R, what does it stand for? PQ4R is an acronym for the first letters of six words. Preview, question, read, reflect, recite, and review. Now, this method of study has been proven to make it effective if you're studying in a classroom. You're studying a chapter in a history book, so to speak. To get the most out of it, you first preview. You skim through quickly the highlights of the whole chapter, looking at the headings of the paragraphs, so you know some idea in broad terms of what it is you're reading about. Are you reading about the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the War of 1812, a Russian War? What are you reading about? And then you question, what are you trying to learn out of that chapter? And then you read, you reflect upon what you've read, you recite over in your mind what it is that you've read, and then you review it again to reinforce what you read. Now that works pretty good if you're studying a history book. It may not work so good if you're studying the Bible, so I changed it up a little bit. It's still going to be PQ4R, but the last two are going to be a little different. Preview, question, read, reflect, review, and remember. I changed the last two, review and remember. So, let's look at each one of these, and I think I can show you what I'm speaking of. This is the way I look at the Scriptures, and to me it's the only meaningful way to look at the Scriptures so you don't get confused. Let me lay this scenario out in front of you. Let's say someone picks up a Bible and they start reading it, and they've not gone to church all their life, but they want to start reading the Bible. So they pick up the book, it just falls open, and they start reading the chapter, and they start reading the chapter over there in the Old Testament, and it talks about the sacrificial system, how you're supposed to do sacrifices. Well, the next night they throw the book down on the bed, and it opens up to the end of the Old Testament before you get to the New Testament, where the Lord says, "I'm sick of your sacrifices. I don't want any more sacrifices." Well, then they throw the book down on the third night, it falls open to the place where it says the Lord wants us to use our bodies as living sacrifices. And the fourth night, the person picks up the Bible and says, "Man, this book is confusing me. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'll just look at the TV guy." Well, you see, if you use this kind of method right here, you sort of know what you were trying to study and what the goal was. We need to study with a purpose. There's places that's full of information that's good for us, and there's places that's just history. Just history. It's good to know, but it's not going to help you with your wife or your husband. I want it to be effective study. So let's first look at the preview. Here's some things we should ask ourselves. If we're going to open up the page in the Bible to read it, who is the writer? Who is it? Is it a prophet? Is it an apostle? Is it somebody that's inspired? Is it just an observer? Is it somebody that's witnessing something? He's not a prophet, he's not inspired, but he's just writing about what he's saying. It'd make a difference. It'd make a difference how I would put trust in his words if I know who the writer is. Well, what's the background of the writer? Is it a Jew? Is it a Gentile? Is it a Christian? Is it a hypocrite? You read in the Bible, and you can read words, and if you look closely at who wrote it, the Bible has recorded the words of hypocrites. So, every phrase that's in the Bible was not meant for us to stake our souls on. Okay, what are the rules? What are the rules we're going by? Are we going by Old Testament rules? Are we studying about New Testament rules? Are we studying about civil law? Deuteronomy and Leviticus, God gave many civil laws telling judges how to judge the people. Good things, but it's not for our salvation. So we need to know what we're reading. What's the situation? What was the writing about? Was it about sin? Was it about war? Was it about tradition? Was it a case of a nation? Or is it a case of an individual? In other words, is the advice given to a nation of Israel, a group of people as a whole? Is it like the seven churches of Asia? Letters with good advice written about whole congregations? Or is it about specific individuals? Say in Corinthians, where the Corinthians had a man there in a case of fornication, and they were told specifically what to do about this specific case for this specific individual with a specific sinful situation. We need to know that. Preview. Now we need to question what we read. What are the desired consequences? Is it, again, consequences for the nation? Or is it consequences for the group? And is it written to correct their thought, or is it written to correct their actions? Much in the Bible is about our thoughts. It's timeless, so to speak. It's not tied to the Old Testament, and it's not tied to the New Testament. It's tied to our thought process. Some of it is for specific actions, things that we should do. Sometimes it's about a change of our view of the past. And we might call that forgiveness. Forgiveness is the desired outcome of the parable or the story. Sometimes it's a change of view of the future, which you might call that repentance. I lived one kind of life in the past, but in the past I hope I'm forgiven for the past, and so now I'm reading with the consequence of my future. I want my future to be different than my past. That's called repentance. We're going to change and turn our lifestyle around. Okay, now here's the big one. Will it apply to me? Is what I'm reading going to apply to me? Well, no, there's places you can turn in the Bible. It's a lot of history. And you can read a lot of history. And yes, some of it's going to apply to you. But if you're really looking for something that's going to apply to how you live, there's richer places. I look at the Bible like this. Most of you used to hunt rabbits and things like that. And if you're going to go out and hunt rabbits and be successful, you didn't go out in the middle of the blacktop and try to pick them up. You didn't go out in the middle of a close-cut field and try to pick them up. You go around and you look for the places where you found them before. You look for where they're going to be. The Bible is the same way. You can go to the Bible and read pages and pages and pages and get some things that will teach you, but there's other places that are richer. Just deeper treasures. Almost every verse is something that just hits you. That's the way I look at the New Testament and space of the Gospels. That's the stuff that turns your life around. A lot of stuff's good to know, but there's things that just really hit you. Will it apply to me? Is it in the Old Testament? Is it in the New Testament? Is it a good thought, or is it a direct doctrine, something I've got to follow? Okay, now we're going to read. How do we read the Bible? How do we read? Read it fast for the story. If you're reading about the story, read on. If all you're reading for is the story, cruise on. Read it fast. Read it slow for the details. If you want the details. Sometimes people get in a thing of reading the Bible, and they get on one of these, read the Bible through in a year, and you got so many chapters you're supposed to read, and sometimes they try to switch you up and read a few chapters a night in the Old Testament, a few chapters a night in the New Testament. Well, that's better than nothing, in my opinion. Just my opinion, that's better than not reading at all. But if you're not careful, you're going to start intertwining the stories between the old and the new, and you're not going to be able to keep up the thread of thought in the old and the thread of thought in the new, and your reading time is not going to be as efficient as it would be if you honed in. And some people say, well, I won't try to read a chapter a night. Well, that's good. That's good if you can read a chapter a night. And that might be the best way for you to do it. But from my standpoint, I'd much rather you read two verses. And I mean dig through those verses and get everything out of those verses and just wear those verses and claim those verses and own those two verses. Then say, I read two chapters last night. Especially when you get over there and talk about those verses and says, avoid the appearance of evil. If you just sit there on that one verse and just think and meditate about all the things, the implications of that one statement, avoid the appearance of evil. How much different would you view the next day? Read slower for the intent. You can read through a chapter and say, okay, I know that chapter talks about Paul's missionary journey. Then you can read that thing a little bit slower, and you can find out that applies to Paul's and the hardships of his missionary journey. And then you could read even slower for the intent, and you think, this is about Paul's journey, his hardships, and what he was, I can almost feel what he was thinking, why he went through what he did. So you're bearing down on the intent of what the Scriptures want us to know. Now, reflect. To me, out of all these six things, PQ and four R's, this is the toughest one. But it's also the most rewarding one, the one that we'll learn the most from. Reflect. What led the characters to their actions? And I'm going to throw one out here. We've all got our favorite characters, but I'm going to throw out an Old Testament character. Why did Daniel not want to eat the king's food? And I love to eat. And I eat all kinds of things. I don't eat as many things now as I used to eat. I kind of watch certain things. But why? What led Daniel? We have absolutely nothing that I found. You may know. You may know exactly where to turn and read about Daniel's diet. But I can't remember reading anything about why Daniel did not want to eat the king's food as far as just pure diet goes. What led Daniel to that? These are things I'm talking about. Imagine when you read these stories. Why did these people do what they did? Why? What beliefs? Was it his upbringing? Was it his belief? If it was good enough for Daniel and he was such a great prophet, maybe we should be practicing what Daniel did. What were the circumstances behind why people did what they did? What could have led them to that? Put yourself in the story. This is hard. This is hard because what this means is you got to see yourself. And this is one of the hardest things. The hardest person that we'll ever try to see is us. We can see anything and everything about everybody else. We can tell everybody what's wrong with them from the way they look, the way they act, the way they spend their money, the way they spend their time. We can point that out. It's just as clear as a blueprint, a profile on the wall. We can identify things in other people, but we cannot sometimes see our own image. We can't see that we are the same kind of people we're accusing other people of being. It's hard to do. Examine your own self to see whether you are in the faith, whether you're worthy to take of the Lord's Supper. Put yourself in the story of the Bible, and who would you be? No, no, no. We would not be the people in the foot of the cross mocking Jesus to call for his crucifixion. No, we would not do that. But what other things do we do? The Bible says you crucify him afresh because of some of the things you're doing. But we would not say that we would be that kind of person. What would you have felt if you'd been in that story? What would you have done if you had been in that story? And then bring the story to the present. Bring it from 2,000 years ago to today. Bring it from 2,000 years ago to what your buddies want you to do on a Saturday night. Your friends, your peers. Where they want you to go on a Saturday night, what they want you to do, what they want you to drink, the kind of fun they want you to have, the fun they make because you don't want to go with them. Bring those Bible stories up to 2005. Put yourself in those situations and say, what would I have done? Who would I be in that story? What's a similar situation and what's the similar characters? Life goes in cycles. And it still repeats itself. Human nature. The only thing that changes is our speed of transportation and communication. But human thought, nature, habits, the things we do and let ourselves do, it just goes around and around in cycles. Okay, now we want to review. We've read it. We've reflected upon it. We want to review. Let's look at the circumstances again. Let's look at the characters again and see do we have a clear picture of what's in the Bible. Look at the story and the consequences again. And make sure we bleed everything out of these stories. Did I get all of the meaning? Did I get the right meaning? Is there a second message in it? I learned a lesson a few later, 10 years ago, with the Grand Canyon. Never been to a place that big at one time. You can't see it all. You just stand in one spot and just soak in all that you can. I've never been to a place. Most of you are like me, raised here in Alabama. And unless you live up on one of these ridges and just kind of gaze out upon the valleys around you, you don't realize the effect that clouds have on the lighting of the surroundings. But standing in one spot on the edge of the Grand Canyon, it's so big and you can see so far that the clouds overhead will shadow certain parts of it and the sun will shine on the other parts. And if you stand there in one spot, it's like a kaleidoscope of colors that change before your eyes because of the change of the clouds. And you can stand in one spot at 10 o'clock in the morning and come back to that exact spot at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you'll see something different. The Bible is like that to me. Not that it's changing, but I'm changing. As I go through life, I can go back and read parables that I read a year ago. And all of a sudden, it just becomes three-dimensional. It just jumps out of the page at me. It's talking to me. That parable is talking to me. And I've heard that parable, and I've read that parable, and I've seen it in black and white, and I can recite that parable to you, but all of a sudden, bingo, the thing's talking to me. Review what you've read. Even if you've read it 10 times, review it again. Remember, most stories teach timeless lessons. Human events usually recycle to break a bad chain of events in human nature. You've got to apply the lessons. Listen, have you witnessed generations that had bad characteristics? How often that generation passed those bad characteristics to the generation behind it, and to the generation behind it, and to the generation behind it? Now, I'm not all that old. You think when I say this, you think, boy, you must be real old. But I know a family of 4 generations. I don't know what about the 5th one above it. Don't know about the outcome yet of the one below it. But 4 generations that I've witnessed have exhibited a certain arrogance and cockiness and independence that has not been good in those families. 4 generations of it. You can see it. Now, to break the bad chain, something's got to happen. Son and daughter can't keep doing what mom and daddy taught them that they learned from their grandma and granddad. Somebody's got to be bold enough and educated enough, and education changes attitudes. Education changes attitudes. Somebody's got to be bold enough to step out of line and break that chain of bad personality traits and make sure that they don't pass them on to their kids and their grandkids. To maintain a good chain, apply the lessons. You cannot consistently apply what you cannot and do not remember. What you remember. Okay, let's have a little fun now. Let's look at one that we have. I know forwards and backwards. Let's look at the parable that Jesus gave in Luke 14, verses 16 through 24. And I'm going to put it up here. If you want to read off the screen, if you want to open your Bible, that's quite all right. And I want to use this method right here and look at this passage. We're going to preview right now, okay? If somebody tells you that they want you to look at a passage in Luke 14, 16 through 24, to preview in your mind, what are you thinking? Well, I know it's in the New Testament. I know that it's one of the Gospels. It's that special period of time and that transition from Old Testament to New Testament where things are lining up to go into the New Testament. I glance at the parable and I realize right off the bat, Jesus is the one doing the speaking. So who's he speaking to? And why is he speaking at all? Well, I read the beginning of chapter 14 and I find out that he's in a Pharisee's house, which doesn't happen very often, but it did this time. And he's speaking to lawyers and Pharisees. So this is the place, this is the people that he's talking to, the lawyers and the Pharisees. And you know, you good Bible students know that he was pretty hard on them. He was right straight to the heart with these people because he knew he wasn't going to have any chances to talk to them before they were going to get him killed. And he hit them hard and straight. Okay, when Jesus speaks, this is my thinking right now. This is me. But I want to show you this. I believe Jesus, all the things that Jesus taught can be summed up in general terms with 3 things. He taught about practices, principles, and prophecies. All right? That's important. practices, principles, and prophets, and prophecies. When Jesus spoke about practices, that was good. But a lot of times, Jesus spoke about practices that had to do with the old law, and that in itself does not apply to me. Sometimes Jesus talked about prophecies, and that's good in itself. But a lot of those prophecies didn't apply to me. His word, okay, but where I like to focus is the middle part, is the principles. I want to focus on the principles that Jesus taught. Listen, you get talking to somebody that's on the verge of a divorce, you think you're going to stop it by talking to them about the practice against divorce and remarriage? It's all way beyond that. Those folks needed help with the principles. They needed the principles. I want to tell you, it's the principles that we need to concentrate on. We need to know the principles that Jesus was trying to teach us, and then we wouldn't have near the problem we got trying to enforce practices. Okay, so what's Jesus trying to tell us in this parable? Look at the last one. I added the last one. Jesus is laying down a principle in Luke 14, verses 16 through 24. Okay, here's the question we might ask ourselves. The invitation is to a group or a feast. That's what this is about. This whole parable is about an invitation to a group or a feast. Will they accept it or will they decline it? So here we go. Let's read this. A certain man made a great supper. And as I told you, let's read it through quickly. A certain man made a great supper, and he bade many. He sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, come, for all things are now ready. And they with one excuse began to make excuse. The first said unto him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go and see it. I pray you have need excuse. Another said, I bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I pray you have need excuse. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I pray you have need excuse. Another said, I have married a wife. And therefore I cannot come. So that servant came and showed his lord these things. Then the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in here the poor, the maimed, the halt, and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it is done as you have commanded, and yet there is room. And the Lord said unto his servant, go into the highways and hedges, and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say unto you, that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. Okay? We read it fast. What we get out of it, besides I made a typographical mistake in the middle of it. I'm sure you picked that up. Okay? What do we get? We got an invitation. We got 3 people that declined, and they were put aside, and we got others that came in. So let's go back through it. Let's go back through it and reflect upon all that was in there. Let's look at it again. Now we're going to put ourselves in the story. We have a certain man. Okay? I'm going to ask you the question. Let you decide. Could that have been God? He made a great supper. Could that supper have been heaven? Or an entrance into the kingdom? Perhaps. He bade many. Could that invitation have been the gospel? And could it have only been the gospel, or could it be an invitation anytime you give an invitation to do good? He sent his servant. Okay? Is that servant Jesus? Could be. But what about the time after Jesus died? Could that servant have been evangelists, the people that choose to evangelize the world and take the gospel wherever? Could be. Oh, wait. What if the servant was me? What if it's me? See, now we're getting personal. What if I am the servant that's supposed to go out here and invite people? Okay, it happened at supper time to all that were bidden. Come, for now all things are ready. Now is the time. Okay, think of the wording that Jesus used in this parable. He could have used anything that someone was invited to. Anything, any kind of invitation, but he called it supper time. And you and I know that a call to supper time is different from a call to go down to Walmart and pick up anything. Oh yeah, I'll make a trip to Walmart. I might make it Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, but Walmart's going to be there. It doesn't really matter which day I go. I go anytime. Okay, but it's called supper time, we know. That means come when the food's warm, when it's ready. When Jesus picked supper time, he was narrowing down the time frame that all this was going to happen. He said, now the time is ready. They all was wanting consent, began to make excuse. The first said, I have bought a piece of ground. Okay? Could that represent, perhaps, the man's possessions? Now let's look at the next two, and I'll explain why I think this. The second one said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. Could that have meant the man's profession? The third one said, I have married a wife. Could that represent the man's family? I believe there was a purpose as to why Jesus picked supper time and why he picked these 3 specific things. The land represented our possessions. What makes us feel comfortable because what we got in the bank, so to speak. If we're sitting here with about $1 million in the bank, we got a whole different outlook on life than the person that's living from paycheck to paycheck and 3/4 of the next paycheck gone before they ever get. Whole different outlook on life sometimes. Possessions make a difference. What about the profession? The job we choose, wherever it is. Some people hold their job in such high esteem that it overrules where the family lives. If the family lives close to the church that they can work with, how much time the family spends in church activities, all of that takes second place to the method of making the dollar. The profession is different. And then what about family? Family is good and family is wonderful. And the Bible says we're supposed to take care of our family or we're worse than a bunch of heathens. And yet, the Bible also says, who loves father, mother, son, daughter, so on and so forth, more than me is not worthy of me. So even family's got to be in balance and in check. God's got to be above all. So could these 3 things have meant when Jesus said, piece of ground, yoke of oxen, and family, could this represent just about the sum total of what a man can get involved in life? You tell me what a man can get involved in that is not involved or described by their possessions, their profession, or their family. The servant said, Lord, it is done. Go out into the highways and the hedges and compel. I don't know about you, but that word compel hits me right there. It hits me right there. Compel them. Feel the need to do something to help people. Don't casually go about it as if there's no consequences to what you do. Now, sometimes we get disheartened because we think the people out there in the world and the people who are the people that we love and they know we love them, they won't even listen to us. So what chance have we got to go evangelize people that don't know us and don't care anything about the church, don't have a family in us? And so we sometimes maybe get discouraged and don't reach out to those kind of people. But sometimes there's people that know us, that if we displayed a little more concern and urgency and tried to compel, might make a difference. It's a different word here. Compel them to come in. And then finally, that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. Could this have meant rejection, damnation, destruction for eternity? Is this what he's trying to teach us? I thought it was just an invitation to a supper. Could this really mean eternal damnation? I hope not. Reflect. How many different people are in this story? Who do you want to be? That's not the most important question. The most important question is not who do you want to be. The most important question is who are you? Because you're already one person in this character. Which one is it? The master? The inviting servant? Are you the man with a piece of ground, your possession? Are you the man with the oxen, your profession? Are you the man with a wife, the family, that holds you back from doing what you can do? Are you the angry master who's been rejected and have nothing to do with these men again? Oh, what about the compelling servant? Not just the inviting servant, but the compelling servant. Are you the poor, the maimed, the halt, the blind, those in the highways and the hedges that have got their way lost and they're trying to find their way? At one time we were. I would not think you are that way now, but at one time we were right there. That's the kind of people we were. And I certainly hope we're not in that group. We're not rejected. Where do you want to be? I'll tell you where I want to be. It's right there. I want to be the compelling servant. And here's where the scriptures really, they either lift us up or they kill us. Just how good do we want to be? Just how much of our time and talent do we want to put into what we're doing? I thought about this equipment and all this stuff. I thought about it for a few months. Been using this stuff at work for several years. I knew how effective it was. Hadn't seen anybody else use it in church. Didn't know how to be received. Didn't know if I could afford it. But I thought it would be worth a try. If it would make the word come alive to anybody. Just one person, if the word would just jump off that screen and be alive to somebody, one person, then how could I not try what the Lord gave me the ability to do? So you see, I've answered this invitation. Now, I may not have answered it well, but I'm trying to answer the invitation to teach the most effective way, the most efficient way, the best way that I can for you to get the most out of the word. For 6 months, I tried to memorize all my lessons. And I could stand right there in front of that, and I could go through the whole lesson. It was a good show, but it was exercise in memory. What I'm trying to do now is to get more information, not only vocally, but visually, into your head. Because education changes attitudes. Education changes attitudes. Always remember, Jesus said it this way. Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Okay? Jesus, I believe, taught principles, prophecies, and practices. Which one is that? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. It's not a practice. It's not a prophecy. That's pure principle. You got to make that real in your own life, and it'll turn your life around. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Who do you want to be? I want to be the compelling servant. Who am I? I don't know. If you look at the time I've spent, I hope the Lord forgives me, but I spend so much time doing stuff with my family that I hope that it's acceptable to Him. So I'm afraid that I might be the man with the wife, but I want to be the compelling servant. Who do you want to be? Now let's review. Am I the character that I think I am? Have my possessions, professions, or family caused me to reject an invitation this year? You say, well, that doesn't apply because this was a story. This was given at one time and it was given to the Jews. And the Jews rejected, so it was given to the Gentiles. Well, okay. But let's look at what the Jews were. The Jews were God's people. What if we, being in the church for years and years, we assume that we are God's people, and we get lackadaisical about it, and we don't accept these invitations as they come in. Invitations to do the work we can do. Invitations to learn to speak behind the pulpit, and to speak and try to take all these public relations courses to make us as an effective speaker as we can be. To compel. Speak to compel, not just to take up a lesson on the empty mouth. Not to fill a spot on the schedule, but to compel people, to try to touch people. What about next year? Is it just what we've done in the past, or are we gearing up to be better next year? Remember, invitations to the feast may come often. We may get an invitation to go to a meeting or to go to a revival somewhere. Now, I realize that there's places, it's just far to go. I feel bad that I don't go down and support Brother Danny Abercrombie because he comes up to Randolph County and does so much. But from where I live, to get down there where he is, it's going to be 2 hours. I'm not going to make it 2 hours, and that's just about the limit that I feel like I can drive. Maybe I ought to stretch it and drive farther, but that's just about as far as I can drive. But what about somewhere closer? What's your limit? In your mind, what's your limit? Would you drive within a 20-mile range of your home to go to a revival? How far would you drive to a Walmart, or go to a shop, or go to a sale? If Parisians comes out with a one-day sale, how far would you drive to take your wife to Parisians? How far would you drive? Would you drive in a 50-mile range to go to church? And when you get past that imaginary range that you would drive, what's your excuse? Well, I can't drive that far. I'll drive an hour, but I won't drive an hour in 10 minutes. Could that be the invitation? Could that be the invitation that you turn down? Because of whatever. And not many of us can say we don't have a dependable, comfortable car. What about soft church work? Visiting. Communicating. Writing cards, letters, keeping up with somebody. Look, we all can't keep up with everybody, so let's just scratch that. Let's don't use it for an excuse that I can't keep up with everybody. God doesn't expect you to keep up with everybody. If you look at the prayer list, you would spend 2 hours a night writing cards if you wrote something to everybody on the prayer list. He doesn't expect us to write to everybody, but He expects us to be in contact with somebody. Somebody. Be in contact with somebody. And then there's the hard church work. Hard church work is cutting grass. Doing something for somebody. Cleaning off the grounds for decoration. Making sure the roof's okay. The hard, physical, the stuff somebody's got to do. How many times is it dumped off on one or two? And one or two wind up designed for everybody. It's not that they make wrong decisions, but everybody needs to buy into it. Everybody needs to take hold and be a part. The Lord needs workers, not shirkers. All these are invitations. What about study time? I hate to get too personal here. I hate to get too personal. But you know, the TV guys, it sure is interesting, some of the shows that come on and some of the things that I get interested in to watch on TV, just don't have time to study. What kind of invitation are you turning down there? Example time, being a good example to somebody. Each invitation offers an opportunity to accept or reject. Each one of you had a choice to not come here tonight to this service. Now, you may not think that because you kind of do something out of habit, and that's good. But, truth be known, each one of you had the potential to say, I'm not going to church tonight. I'm going to do something else. You made the choice to come. That's good. You accepted this invitation. But how many invitations do we get between Sunday and the next Sunday? How many different invitations come our way of chances to do good, of chances to be a good example, of chances to study, of chances to do something here? It's out of the ordinary for us. We don't normally do this kind of thing. We normally are church every time the church is open, if it's in Mount Carmel, but not somewhere else. But if it's here, we'll be here. Well, that's good. But how many invitations do we turn down between the Sundays of something to do? And could this parable apply to us? Could it really apply to us? Okay, each choice brings a consequence. You made a choice to come here, that's good. But how many people did not make a choice to come here? Each choice has its own consequence. Everything we do in life, from the things we eat, to how fast we drive, to where we spend our time, to the hobbies we decide to pick up, every choice, every day, has a consequence. And I believe if we look at this passage in Luke 14, chapter, verses 16 through 24, we're going to see more than just an invitation to eat a meal that's turned down by three people. It's offered to the halt, the maimed, the sick, and the blind. I think what we're really going to see in this parable, if we reflect upon it and put ourselves into it, is this is one that affects our lives, the decisions we make every day. This is a modern-day parable. We can read it like it's a parable of 2,000 years ago, But this parable, to me, it's just as fresh in my life as it was when those people heard it. Because I know exactly what he's talking about. And he's talking straight to me. Is he talking to you? If anyone is here tonight, subject to this gospel call, to be partakers of all these wondrous things that the Lord has prepared for us, if there's any way at all that we can be of assistance through obedience to the gospel or through the prayers of the church and the church of all parties, if we can help in any way, please let us while we stand and pray. 6:29.